Hello, everybody, and welcome to the YJBM Science News Podcast, where we discuss the most recent science news from across the Yale community. I'm Sam, first-year Master of Public Health student in the Department of Health Policy.
And I am Mara, a second-year PhD student in microbiology.
Amazing. So excited for today's episode. What do you have for us today?
Well, the first research paper that I want to bring your attention to just came out in Nature, and it talks about how we can regulate fat metabolism to help control inflammation in the colon.
Cool. Can you describe the problem for us?
Sure. So the problem they're dealing with here is colitis. Pretty widespread, probably everybody heard of it, but basically it is a sort of inflammatory reaction in the colon that causes like pretty big damage, needs to be regulated. It can be caused by infection, but it is often autoimmune, so your own immunity begins to be overreactive and attacks normal tissue, and that's the case they're dealing with here. And they focus specifically on one particular cytokine. Cytokine is just a signaling molecule within the like immune system in general. This one is called IL-10, and this one in particular signals the immune system to reduce inflammation instead of bring it up. So it's what we call anti-inflammatory cytokine. And when I say that it reduces inflammation, when somebody is born without it, it needs to be regulated, they will have constant inflammation, and they are much more prone to colitis. That is true for people, and that's true for mice used in the lab. That's one of the models.
Okay, so how did they proceed with this research?
Yeah, so really they wanted to figure out how exactly does this inflammatory interaction happen, what causes this, how it can be regulated. So like really practical questions here. And what they noticed is that with IL-10 deletion in mice, there is sort of reorganization of balance of fatty acids in immune cells in this area. Fatty acids are just a type of molecules that they have their own unique structure. Can be fats, can be different, they can play different roles. And specifically, they found one type, which is called saturated very long chain ceramides, VLC ceramides, and that increased level of them is actually connected to inflammatory processes. So what they did next is they figured out what gene controls the high levels of those ceramides, and then they deleted that gene. And they saw how it influenced inflammation processes both in vitro and in vivo. So practically like in cells in a flask or in a mouse. And they saw that in IL-10 deficient mice, so mice that have high inflammation in the colon that they're prone to colitis, if there is a deletion of this particular gene, so that means low levels of ceramides, that leads to low inflammation levels, even if they don't have any IL-10 to control this process.
What's the bottom line then?
Yeah, so first of all, it really points out that there's this really important balance between levels of different fatty acids in this area. So it's not just connected to like types of immune cell, types of cytokines, but there's also this aspect of metabolism here. And in terms of practical aspects, while they don't focus on, you know, like diet specifically, they do genetic modifications. But they think it's possible that the diets high in unsaturated fats, so the ones that shift this balance, it can be beneficial in treating and controlling colitis. They use this term in paper called metabolic correction. I really like that. I feel like it outlines the process really well, how like diet connects to inflammatory process. And it's also possible that the same kind of problem could be real in other inflammatory diseases. And there are plenty. We're full of inflammation influencing our lives. So they said that maybe like the next directions will be looking at other inflammatory diseases and seeing if there are similar molecules implicated in those reactions.
Yeah, no, I feel like this is the kind of thing that needs to be brought to the mainstream and discussed, because I feel like in general, fats are villainized. And to, you know, talk about good fats and talk about their benefits for inflammatory processes will be really interesting, because I feel like everyone kind of deals with some sort of like inflammation when it comes to, you know, like their gut health or something a little bit more serious. So I think it really is very important to have discussions about like different aspects of our nutrition actually not being, you know, the worst for you.
Yeah, I totally agree. I like what you mentioned about inflammation, but like every one of us has some degree of it, because yes, like there's a balance between immune activation and like immune activation. So we need some degree of inflammation just to be alive. Like,
yeah,
it is a complicated process. And then when it comes to nutrition, instead of demonizing the whole class of compounds, which we can't even really exclude from our diet at all, they're actually going into details of the process and seeing what is the problem.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, fats taste good.
Okay, Sam, can you tell us about the research that caught your attention?
Yeah, so this is a Yale-led study, obviously, that attempts to learn about how the wound healing process in the early developmental stages of humans can be informed by studying the process of wound closure in fruit flies.
Oh, interesting. So how exactly was the study conducted and what did they find?
The study was conducted using experimental data that was already published. But it used that data to model on the computer how cells respond to wounds in fruit fly wings at different stages of development, like, you know, the embryonic stage and the larval stage. And basically what they found was that wound closure can effectively be illustrated by thinking of purse strings closing. So think of, there's an extracellular matrix that surrounds the wound and then shrinks. Kind of like the way the opening of a drawstring purse closes when you close the purse strings, when you like pull on them, right? So, but the key difference that they found during this study was in the speed with which the purse strings close during this, during this process, depending on whether it's in the embryonic stage versus the larval stage. In the embryonic stage, the process happens much faster, which the study posits has a life-preserving effect, because having a wound open for a long time at the early developmental stages could be incredibly detrimental to development as a whole. That being said, the downside of this quicker wound closure leads to differences in, you know, the shape of the cells around the healed wound site, resulting in thinner, more elongated cells that have the possibility, which is, this is the intriguing part, that have the possibility of reverting back to their original shape over time.
I see. So what is the benefit of doing this type of study, I guess, for us?
Yeah, yeah. So we're hoping, well, the scientists doing this, not me, I was not part of that, are hoping that learning about fruit flies will help develop treatments for congenital disorders and prevent long-term damage in humans. So the mechanism of interest, like I just mentioned in particular, is the potential for wounded cells to return back to their original shape, you know, relax back into their original shape. And we want to see how maybe this process could be stimulated by some drug or some other treatment to effectively heal wounds that occur within humans during developmental stages and, you know, heal wounds that could potentially lead to congenital disorders and long-term damage.
I never even thought about the fact that, like, wounds can also happen, like, in embryonic stages. That is something that we need to be trying to figure out how to heal.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like in our basic biology classes, we hear, like, oh, mutations, blah, blah, blah. And when you hear that, I think that it's very easy to think, oh, well, it's kind of hard to just fix a mutation. And so you don't really think about healing that kind of you know, mismatched process in the developmental stages. But when you think of it as a wound, I think that it more effectively and more concretely illustrates the fact that it could be something that we might be able to fix.
I like that thinking.
Yeah, me too. Okay, moving on to our last study of the day. Sad. What's the study about?
Yeah, so the study also uses a non-human organism to illustrate something that can maybe be used in humans in the future. So, long story. 30 years ago, they discovered that a particular marine organism called bryozoa, and for these research they were using a species called Sicuriflusta sicurifrons.
You did it.
Thank you. My Latin is perfect. Those are just, I Googled them, they look like little stones or sponges. They look underwater. They're very simple organisms. But while they're simple organisms, they contain some very unique molecules that we don't really see anywhere. And The bottom line is that not only we don't see them anywhere, but we haven't been able to synthesize them because I am not a chemist, but from what I understand, they're very, very packed and they have very unique chemical interactions between parts of the structure, which is just hard to replicate synthetically. And the cool thing is that one of the yellow labs was in fact able to synthesize 8 of them using novel like methods of designing synthesis pathway. And what also is really cool is that, so when you synthesize something, not only you need to proceed with the pathway, but also you need to determine what is it that you got in the end, right? And the scientists say that it was hard to use like most current methods for structure determination, so they went with microcrystal electron diffraction analysis methods, which I think was really cool as a non-chemist.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So what's the importance of this research?
Well, the reason why we had such interest in like bryozoa and marine organism chemistry in general is that, so we are running out of sources for synthesizing novel drugs like antibiotics, anti-cancer molecules, things like that. And we're getting a lot of inspiration from nature, which I think is wonderful. I mean, penicillin is a fungal organism. And this is an example of that. So there have been implications that bryozoa have like molecules that can in the future be used as models for like anti-tumor or antibiotics. And being able to synthesize those really complex molecules give us hope that we'll actually be able to do it on a larger scale.
Well, I did not realize. I feel like we don't hear about this, you know, nitty-gritty, how the sausage is made about different drugs and different treatments that we have, that I didn't realize that we were running out of, how did you call it, like ways to synthesize our important molecules?
Not only ways to synthesize, but most of my antibiotics we have right now are pretty similar. So they're divided into several classes, but all those classes rely on their own like parent molecules, so to say. And recently, like running out is maybe not the correct term, but if we look at statistics, there was a period where we kind of discovered most of antibiotics, and then for the last decades, we didn't really find anything new. So, and that's the problem, because bacteria are constantly finding ways to fight our antibiotics off.
Yeah.
So you have to pick up the pace.
Wow, that's so interesting. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think that your articles this week were like really interesting, and they really opened up, I don't know, at least my knowledge about more like hard biology things, because I tend to be more in my health policy space, and I love hearing about these every week.
Well, shout out to authors of the papers.
Yeah, you're the real ones.
Okay, guys. Well, it was great being with you this week, and we will see you next week again, probably with 3 or 4 articles. Looks like the pace is picking up.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you guys again. Have a good week. Bye.